Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the next episode of the Disclosure Podcast. I am your host, Ed, and today I am very fortunate and grateful to be joined by Rich Hardy. So thank you so much for coming onto the podcast, Rich. And I think we're going to have a really interesting discussion today because I know that you've done some incredible things. And by incredible, I mean brave and courageous and life-affirming and vegan-affirming in so many ways. And so without maybe telling your story, perhaps I could ask you, well, tell me a little bit about yourself and kind of what encouraged you to get into what you used to do, which was undercover investigations.
Hey, yeah, thanks very much for the intro, Ed. Yeah, it's been a bit of a long journey. I got into sort of activism around 1993 as a teenager, but before that, I was very much involved in day-to-day life with a vegetarian family, which actually kind of all made the switch during my sort of teens. So it was a family that, you know, grew its own food, had a lot of rescued animals, and would actually like be involved with, like, you know, actions and protests at a sort of fairly grassroots level. So, you know, from a small child, I was, you know, hanging out with my folks at slaughterhouse protests and not really being completely aware, I guess, of everything. But I gradually, like, with the animals around the family, I got more connected with them. And investigations came a little later. It was like more mainstream campaigning first. But it started, I think, probably around about the age I was 15. And I was at 16, I was about to sign with a professional football club. And I was the only vegan in the squad at the time. So this was like 1988. And I got dropped last minute. And that's absolutely fine, because I think what it did do was like put me back in focus about like my veganism and my family and our animals. And yeah, I set about wanting to get involved more directly with campaigning. And so campaigning came first, and then later on in life, investigations. So it was started an early seed, I guess, that sort of developed and grew, and it's sort of been ongoing since then.
So I guess in many ways you've kind of been around, and you've been, if not necessarily directly campaigning for animals, you know, living in a vegan lifestyle and helping animals pretty much, well, for such a long time now, that you've seen the movement grow in so many ways.
Yeah.
And so I guess it must be quite exciting to kind of see what's happening, well, happening now, and what's happened the past few years, and how it's really starting to kick off for so many different reasons.
Yeah, I mean, I got into like campaigning for farm animals in 1993, and like pure vegan advocacy was pretty low on the ground at that point. So I actually did have to like go into animal welfare campaigning, mm-hmm. and trying to make improvements for farm animals from a welfare perspective. And even though I was vegan at that stage and my family were vegan, it was an organization. It was called Compassion in World Farming,
yeah.
which is the Compassion bit. It's a lovely name. And there was a lot of great things actually about that group during that early period. It wasn't quite where I was, but you know, I thought, well, I might as well try and help move things on a little bit. So started campaigning for farm animals. There's a lot of a big protest movement through the 1990s with live animal exports. So sort of spent a lot of time like organizing protests around the country. We used to ship, you know, several million, you know, sheep and calves out, you know, week in, week out from the UK through Dover. And it was actually the first time I saw sort of the smaller animal rights community that existed at that point, joined by what I would say was called Middle England. It was actually sort of like the Blue Rinse Brigade, you know, little old ladies, you know, with like pink and purple coloured hair, who were, you know, taking to the streets, going to their local port, going to the airports, protesting against the live animal export industry as it tried to get, you know, British animals out to, you know, Southern Europe on long, horrendous journeys by sea and air. So, that's how it started, like campaigning. And then I also worked on campaigns to stop sows being kept in sow stalls at an EU level. Campaign for legislation for EU animals to be recognised as sentient, which was quite a groundbreaking piece of legislation at the time. But just generally, you know, sort of through the 90s, there was a start of a sort of more of an interest in farm animal issues. But it did get led by welfare. And I think that's probably the difference now. You know, we've moved on a little bit from that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, rights organisations and, you know, individuals very passionate about, you know, these issues are taking this into real, you know, new territory for making animals' lives better and safer for the future. So that evolution, if you like, has been really interesting seeing. And it's been interesting seeing how welfare initiatives, although they, you know, they have advanced a lot of things, I think are being superseded by, you know, vegan advocacy and plant-based solutions and, you know, innovation coming out of, you know, the west coast of the US and, you know, just showing us how much, you know, we don't need to be reliant on animals anymore and that they are worth more than just something on our plates to devour.
And it's interesting you mentioned about compassion and well farming because I think they're one of the biggest, well, they're still a huge global organization. They do so much work from an animal welfare perspective. And so I think what you touched on is really interesting in the sense of it seems like we're moving past the need for kind of welfare. And it's something that a lot of vegans, I think, really struggle over, isn't it? You know, should I sign this petition or support this campaign? Do I need to do that anymore? And there's a lot of, you know, with caged free hens, you know, and sometimes I feel like it's a little bit, for me, I feel like it's a bit of a betrayal when we celebrate these hens being taken out of cages and put in free range bands and we say like victory for the animals, and that always sits a little bit uneasy with me. And so I think I echo what you mean about we're kind of moving, we're in like a post-welfare phase of activism, if you like.
Definitely. I think, you know, I always saw it as a stepping stone for people, you know, sign a compassion petition and learn more about, you know, the dairy industry or factory farming. And, you know, over time, I've seen a lot of people, you know, the sort of penny start to drop a little bit and things click into to action. But, you know, I think the welfare side of things has been a necessity. Mm-hmm. I think we have had to try and, you know, advance animal rights through that. And, you know, it's still there. But the exciting thing is I think there's less importance on it right now. I think, yeah, there are solutions that don't involve animals that can make our lives easier to live and without causing any suffering. So why shouldn't we be looking at those, especially when they tick all the boxes around, you know, health, environment and animals as well. It's we'd be silly not to ignore them. So yeah, it's been a part, and I think it's just a lesser part than what it used to be, and that's where I can really see progress right now.
Yeah, and I think I definitely echo that. And it's just, I think the point of the matter is now we're getting so much information through about, you know, as you say, the environment and our health, and it's no longer this idea of do we need to eat these products. You know, I think welfare and a lot of that is rooted in the idea of that perhaps we need to, or there's a reason why we should, so we should make it as good as possible. And I think, you know, if you are under the impression that we need to eat animal products, then that seems like a great idea. But now we're getting told time and time again that there's no need, and it's even better if we don't. And so I absolutely agree. So what took you from, say, compassion in world farming, and then what took you to that next stage? What was that drive to make you say, well, actually, I think I need to go further in my advocacy and activism?
Yeah, I mean, I spent a lot of time lobbying politicians, you know, sort of delivering reams of scientific evidence that, you know, was showing that it was bad to keep a hen in a cage. And there was so much of it, but I was so reliant on, you know, sort of black text on white paper. It just wasn't enough. You know, they needed to see more. They needed to see imagery. And I would say, like, at the tail end of the 1990s, imagery and animal rights was quite weak. You know, it was, we didn't have a lot to call on. You know, we couldn't provide a lot of testimony to show what was happening, you know, behind the locked doors of the factory farm. So it was that conversation, actually, that sort of led me to think, well, the scientific evidence isn't enough at this stage. We need imagery. We need something more powerful that we can hook people in on this and just show the realities of what's happening on the ground, because, you know, the milk adverts on the TV, they're not going to show you the veal crates at that stage, or the, you know, the dairy cows that are hobbling around after, you know, years and years of lactation. And that's what I felt was needed. So I just got myself some cheap cameras and just thought I'd have a crack at it, really.
Have a crack at it. So, and you did more than just have a crack at it. I mean, you did like 100 assignments in, and I've got it read, I had 28 countries, it says, for around 20 or so animal protection societies. You did.
Yeah, I don't think I ever envisaged it going on that sort of long and that far. But I mean, there was a few people around, you know, doing it, and yeah, there was a few people in the States that had done it for a little while, and you know, a little sort of pocket of people in the UK, and I think sort of from the UK that did sort of spread a little across Europe and stuff. So yeah, it was all fairly sort of not very well conceived. You know, it was all sort of led by the heart a little bit and less by the mind, but it was a start. And you know, just sort of like getting some cameras together and just sort of walking into, you know, some places and making a start on this, showed what was possible, I think, and the potential of it. And yeah, I did my first like assignment in New Zealand in a egg laying farm battery cage unit, and of course I got caught on the day, and but because there wasn't a threat, not a perceived threat at that time, you know, it was a slap on the wrist, you know, nothing too bad. So
caught by the police, you mean, or by
just by the farmer. Yeah, I mean, yeah. You wouldn't even have to contemplate the police at that stage. No. You know, it was just a quizzical question of what are you doing in here, you know. And so I left with some images, and I thought, well, I've got to do something with these. So yeah, I took them to the big city in Auckland and dropped in with a group there. And you know, what was nice to see was that they were interested in making use of them and thought they had some value. So so that was the spark, really, you know. And I came home and, you know, met a few more people involved in doing these projects, and yeah, got a few more extra cameras, and just sort of patched a few things together to see what was possible. And then yeah, I just started talking to groups and working with others who were involved with groups, and these sort of investigations began to become more important and more mainstream. And yeah, some of the groups really started to sort of think, well, this could be really valuable to us, and we'll invest some time in developing them. So that was the starting point.
Were you shooting analog or digital at that time?
It was analog, yeah. Wow. Yeah, it was just analog.
I mean, was digital around at that time?
No.
So you were shooting, what, 16 mil?
Like, really just simple cameras, you know, just like cameras you take on holiday with you. You know, if you had them to hand, and just start using them. And then you sort of learned a little bit more about, you know, some of the other equipment. And I'm definitely not a filmmaker, and I'm not a photographer. I don't class myself as either of those, because I'm not skilled enough to actually feel like I can justify calling myself that. I actually look at it more as like video, as evidence gathering, a visual evidence gatherer, if you like. And that was really how I was using it. It was not about the quality of the image. It was the evidence, because the evidence just wasn't there. And that's what I think helped groups you know, have more credibility with the issues that they were talking about.
Yeah. And so you went from kind of just wandering into farms and obtaining footage to applying for jobs in these places.
Yeah, I mean, some jobs. I ended up sort of specializing in a few different areas, really, but the one I did most work in was like infiltration. And sometimes that can come in the form of getting a job in places. But because I like work quite internationally, you know, sometimes the challenges of getting, you know, lawful employment in places is kind of tricky. So, yeah, a lot of it was sort of based around, you know, generating like cover stories, really, and using those. So if you imagine, you know, the sort of stories that like Sky News journalists or Panorama journalists go undercover with, you know, traffickers. You know, there's not jobs that exist as such, but you become part of that community. And, you know, for some projects, you needed to work like that. So, like, yeah, particularly around sort of fur trapping, circuses. But, like, factory farming projects would be more, and slaughterhouse projects would be a mix of different strategies and techniques. It rarely, for me, was night stuff. You know, it was rarely going into places out of business hours. What I found useful of visiting places in the middle of the day is that people are working, and you see that interaction then with people and animals. And I think, you know, the systems, you know, frustrate me so much, and, you know, they're so emotional to see. But the interaction with people and animals is, yeah, like, for me, the real, real toughie, because that's when you do see humans at their worst around animals. And it's usually even the most sort of ridiculous situations, you know, animals being beated or prodded with electric goads when there was no need for it. You know, they were going towards their final point. It was just the frustration of the person, you know, with the stick or the goad that just, you know, really makes me sad. You know, it does make me sad, you know, because people don't understand animals and their behavior in these places. So, but yeah, different stories for different projects. Some were sort of research positions. Some were business ventures. It's the one area of the work that I feel quite at odds about, because it involves, you know, it's involved telling lies. And, you know, I generally like people, but and I feel at odds a little bit, you know, if I'm not telling the truth. But I think these are issues that are in the public's interest to know about. And, you know, when these kind of systems, you know, there's no open invites generally to factory farms or slaughterhouses.
Yeah.
You know, there's no, well, I guess we're moving a little bit along as a CCTV, but generally, you know, people don't want the stuff to be seen. So it's in the public's interest to know what happens so they can make an informed choice for themselves.
Absolutely. It's about raising awareness. And then I think people do generally speaking, they at least find it upsetting, and that and even if they continue to buy those products, it tells them something about how they feel about it, and then they can look at other issues about why they eat those products, whether it's just habit or taste. But if they get an understanding that they recognize it's wrong, then that's profound, because up until that point, why would you ever consider it, and why would you think it's wrong, and why would you think that it's anything other than humane, for example?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so you said you'd go during the day, and you just kind of just ask to go in, or would you kind of have a bit more of a backstory to your
Yeah, there would be plenty of backstory. Yeah. It depends on the country, really. You know, the UK is a bit of a toughie. You know, the fairly aware of, you know, the threats of activists doing this type of activity, and, you know, they're aware that people try and get jobs in places, and they're aware that, you know, covert camera equipment, body worn stuff is, you know, pretty damn good, and you have to look pretty hard for it sometimes. But, you know, in other countries the levels are, you know, a lot less to worry about. And I think, you know, when you do your research a little bit and you understand, I think the most important thing for me is understanding the industry, you know, knowing how it works. And, well, that's one great thing that I loved about doing investigations, is that I got to know what the industry thinks, how it feels, what it fears. And that was all knowledge that I could pass on to others that could do something that with that information, like campaigners. So you're gathering imagery, but you're also gathering intelligence, which you can, you know, use to further your campaign work. So yeah, a range of different stories, a range of different tactics about getting into places. And but yeah, some days it's It's just that in and out quick.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I've done a couple of things. On dairy farms, it seems mostly. And one time we just kind of, well, we kind of got this gear, like this like dog walking gear or something really ridiculous. And then they're like, oh, what are you doing? And obviously, because we've got like, we're supposed to be, I guess, hikers, but hikers with big cameras and lenses, like that doesn't stick out strangely. Yeah. Oh, what are you doing? I'm like, oh, we're just going for a walk and we came across, you know, your cows and we thought we'd film them because yeah. I've never seen a calf before. And, yeah. you know, and my friend was like, oh, my daughter really loves animals and she would love it if I could take some pictures. And he was like, the farmer was like, okay. And then I think we got to the point where we started to overstay our welcome and it all okay. started to get a little bit touchy. So, but it is interesting how there, you know, I think sometimes there's this idea that this footage comes from these extreme, like, you know, ALF scenarios. And actually a lot yeah. of the time, a lot of this footage, and I think increasingly so, is just people wondering and just going and filming and just kind of embracing that aspect of, you know, I'm here to document this. And, you know, right. if someone says something, I'll deal with it, but I've got a job to do and I'm here to do it kind of thing.
Yeah. I like what you've said there a lot. I think citizen journalism is, you know, playing a really important part in our movement. And yeah, obviously, you know, we live with cameras in our pockets, you know, all the time. And so because we're aware and our senses are heightened about these systems, you know, we are going to find ourselves in situations where we might be able to document something mm-hmm. just with those kind of situations. But yeah, I guess there's different levels of complexity of what you want to achieve and how you want to do it and where the laws, you know, are going to merge into, you know, putting yourself at risk or not at risk. And also understanding, you know, what is the value of overstepping the law, or how does that impact on, you know, what you're trying to achieve? You know, are you going to be undermining what you're trying to achieve by, you know, breaking laws? So, yeah, different people have different perspectives on it, but I think citizen journalism is placing a really important part for our movement right now.
I think we both are probably on the same wavelength about that then, which is good. Yeah, I think when it comes to anything that we do, I guess from an activism perspective, it doesn't really matter what it is, but you always have to weigh up, like, the, I guess it's like that cliche pros and cons list and see, you know, do the ends justify the means, and does me putting myself in this situation, is the footage or the positive side of that I can obtain, does that outweigh the potential negatives? And, you know, as you say, whether that be a legal negative or maybe just a general public awareness negative, and if you overstep that mark, is that going to turn people away? It's a real fine line sometimes to decide, isn't it?
It is. And I think when you know, like, laws are being broken, you know, for example, you know, lots of the factory farming systems where we know they're bad and cruel, but, you know, day to day they're breaking their own legislation just because they are, that's what they do. But yeah, knowing how your material is going to be perceived, you know, thinking through the implications, biosecurity is probably the right one that is probably more increasingly to be considered of, and I think most activists are pretty good on that these days.
And so, I mean, I think we've spoken a little bit about, you know, that you've done quite a few things. I was wondering maybe if we could discuss what some of those, not to say those things were, but some of the things you've seen, maybe, if there are things you're happy to discuss. And and so maybe if we start with the factory farming aspect of it, in kind of your I suppose the word would be career as an investigator, what kind of things did you see that you kind of shocked you, or maybe you felt that had the biggest impact when you gave them to organizations or you were part of releasing them?
Yeah, I mean, factory farming is so huge, isn't it? It's like, where do you start? It's, you know, it's a story of individuals, but it's replicated, you know, with millions. Every animal's experience the same pain and suffering as the, you know, their sibling in the cage next door. Or it's I mean, individual stories have cropped up, a lot of it. I mean, I often think and remember situations with individual animals that, you know, are really hard to shake, and their story is really important to me and I think powerful. Yeah, it's pretty tricky. I mean, one of the things that I've focused on is I've not done I don't spend a lot of time like focusing on one company or one farm. I've always gone about doing investigations by gathering a lot of information from 30, 40, 50, 60 farms in one system and across not just one, but two, three, four, five, six countries, because you don't want to be showing the industry that this is just one bad apple. You know, you want to be showing this is systematic cruelty across a big system. So so factory farming is always, I always think of it in the scale. It's just so big. But I think recently, rabbits, I've done a lot of project work on factory farming rabbits. Mm. And because it's one of those, it doesn't seem right, you know, that we farm rabbits. You know, it really doesn't. And I think most people would think that we don't factory farm rabbits. But, you know, there are more rabbits in cages, battery cages, than there are in egg-laying hens across Europe. It's, you know, 320-odd million. And, yeah, they have a really, really tragic life. I mean, they're such sensitive creatures and, you know, very docile, and they suffer a lot of respiratory infections. One of the things that I often think about when I visit rabbit farms is that so many of them have like head tilts. So they're in the cage and they're always like looking up to the ceiling. They're never able to look at you straight, you know. And obviously that's a difficult moment anyway, looking at an animal, you know, straight in the eyes, you know, through the bars of a cage. But I think just seeing them, you know, collapsed and just not able to get their heads level, they're just looking up at the ceiling or down at the like shitty floor below them where everything gets, you know, dropped through, that's always pretty sad. And I always see them just being like treated with so many antibiotics, you know. It's just, it's pretty routine for rabbit farms. Pigs, you know, real individuals. I remember in Italy, you know, a lot of the prestigious farms, prestigious hams, you know, all based on factory farming, despite their wonderful marketing and fancy names and artisanal wording. It's all based in factory farming. And yeah, those systems in Italy are really sad. Sows just, you know, left in corridors, you know, for a weekend until a pet truck arrives to take it away. No care, no attention. A lot of, yeah, dairy stuff, you know, is really moving, because you really do clearly see that bond between mother and calf. And, you know, when that's removed, it's, you know, it's pretty difficult to argue against there being a connection between mother and calf. So that's always quite sad to see. And, yeah, just carpets of broiler chickens. You know, just like 7 weeks old, 8 weeks old. You know, I've done a lot of work on broiler chicken farms in the US. And, yeah, I mean, it's amazing how these big warehouses just fill up, you know, over the space of a few weeks. And, you know, space becomes a premium. But it wouldn't matter if there was enough space for the chickens, because, you know, at that stage, their skeleton has given up on them. And... you know, there's the water close to them, but, you know, they can look at it, but they can't reach it because their bodies can't take them that far. So, yeah, lots to think about, lots to remember, but, you know, lots to be hopeful about as well, I think.
Yeah, I think that's good. And I think it is, the rabbit thing, I think, is interesting. And I find it, I think it's almost kind of that aspect of, I guess you'd say it's almost that speciesist side of me where I actually have eaten rabbit, but, you know, I've never really been around rabbit in supermarkets. You know, being in England, it's not something that we're used to, but what we don't realize is you get into mainland Europe and it's a big thing, you know, and still is, unfortunately. And it's so strange to me, because rabbits are like, they are potentially, you know, well, they are definitely one of the most abused animals in the world, because, I mean, we abuse them for pets, and we abuse them for food, we abuse them for fur, and we abuse them for testing in such, you know, by the millions. And and you think about the temperament of a rabbit and how they're so docile and so sweet, and they're just probably one of the most loveliest and cuddliest animals on the planet. And it's almost because of those attributes that we abuse them to the extent that we do. And it's,
yeah, you're right.
I just don't know how people have them as pets, but then also buy cosmetics and shampoos and all these horrible things where rabbits have been exploited in the same way. The disconnect is so obvious with rabbits, I find.
Yeah, I mean, even the factory farmers, you know, a lot of them tell me like how unsuited they are to this. Yeah, they, you know, they farm them every day. And actually, some of the factory farms that I've been to in southern Europe, it's one industry where women play a key role in ownership and management of factory farms, which is really unusual because that's not something that you see a lot of. But, you know, some of the factory farmers there, they, you know, they really feel that the rabbits give them company. They work alone, you know, with 30,000 rabbits. And some of the women that I've spoken to there, you know, because they're not around other people or any workers, that, you know, they're company for them, and they're talking to them, and they've got the radio playing, and that all stops, you know, when the slaughter truck arrives. And it's a little bit odd, you know, some of the thinking that goes into this. But I think, you know, factory farmers is something that we were given. You know, farmers were told it was the right thing. Mm-hmm. You know, we needed to produce lots of food. It's just the system that everyone got used to. And it's only now that, you know, we have stronger relationships with animals that we started to question that. But there's a fear. There's definitely a fear running on the ground in factory farming. A lot of them over the last few years, where I've worked closely with, are beginning to really consider what they do. They are fearful of the change. They are really aware of public changing opinion. And it starts actually in their own families, because their kids, they don't want to run the factory farm. They want to go to the city. And okay, maybe going to the city is not the best thing for everyone, but they don't want to be part of this business. And a lot of farms are starting to close. So I wanted to say that because I think it just does show that our movement is having traction at that level. And we're not going to get those messages from the industry, but the people working for the industry are definitely scared.
I've spoken with a couple of farmers relatively recently, and they sometimes say something like, and I don't think they realize the power of what they mean when they say it. They'll say something like, I really wish you'd stop sharing this. You have no idea how much it's damaging our industry. I'm like, you shouldn't tell me that, because I'm just going to share it more. So, but there does seem to be this, as you say, fear almost of things are changing. And I think as a vegan, what I try really careful not to do is get ahead of myself in the sense of convince myself that there's more vegans than there is. You know, we're still a small amount of the demographic, but the influence we're having is transcending beyond just vegans. It's, you know, everyone's considering the foods they eat now. Well, you know, those animal products, and whether they're adopting flexitarianism or not, you know, and there's so many issues around that, of course, but the point is people are considering this for the first time ever.
Yeah.
And I think that's hugely down to the pressure that vegans are putting on, you know, in social media or in the industry itself, which means that people are now having to confront these actions within themselves. And I think that includes farmers as well, who have never really had to think about it, and no one's ever told them it's wrong. And all of a sudden this small but very loud, you know, group of people are telling them it's wrong, and they've got to say, well, hang on, is it wrong? Should I listen to them? And it is really interesting.
It is interesting.
We're going into a very fascinating time in terms of animal farming. And I think there was that story recently about a farmer who was driving to the slaughterhouse, and he turned around and took the lambs to a sanctuary. So it is playing on people's minds.
There's definitely more of those stories surfacing. Right. But I mean, I think, yeah, so, you know, when you work on any sort of campaign, you know, like you start with the, you know, first you're ignored and then you're laughed at and then you're for against, and then change tends to happen. And it almost feels like that cycle is moving on to the sort of fight back from them a little bit. That's where I can see some progress, definitely.
Definitely. I mean, I think we see fight back both kind of, you know, trying to stop something as simple as trying to stop plant milks from legally being allowed to be called milk. That's a good example of that fight back. And another would be, you know, you know, this, I guess, trying to tarnish the reputation of vegans by calling us militant and extremists and all these things, is we're definitely in that phase now where people don't seem to be laughing anymore, which is good. You know, we're no longer sandal wearing hippies or whatever the joke would be. And the jokes are so, they're just old now. No one's laughing, and it's becoming more, I guess,
it's credible. It's got credibility. That's the traction it's got. And it's not just like, you know, more people think it's wrong to do this to animals. It's also, you know, well, if I stop eating meat and I start thinking about eating plants, then yeah, I'm going to maybe have a impact on the environment and our climate too, because the world's global scientific community are telling us that's what we have to do. We have to cut down the amount of meat and dairy in our lives. So, you know, when you see those kind of sources like coming up from activism on the streets and being met by the scientific community, we just want to want that government one to come down and meet us all in the middle, I think.
And it's got to happen at some point, right? Maybe we'll get this Brexit business sorted and then we can start focusing on some really important issues like the environment. Yeah. And I guess what I find frustrating but also kind of liberating as well is a lot of the issues that we talk about, especially with the environment, but also with health as well, they're just not contentious issues in the scientific community anymore. Like, it's been readily agreed on, this is a problem. And I think that that's really starting to be reinforced within people's, you know, dietary choices as well, that people are actually listening to what the science is saying.
Definitely.
And so, okay, so the factory farming stuff is very, I think it's really, I mean, I don't want to use the word interesting. I think it's a difficult word to use, but it really touches upon, I guess, the tactics of an industry that have managed to basically trick everyone to thinking that pigs and cows and chickens and of course rabbits belong to like a collective group, and they are absent of individuality and they exist more as just a category of animal. But what I think is interesting with some of the other work you did, especially with circuses, is we don't have that disconnection. Part, I think, of the appeal of animals in circuses is we recognize them as being these very fantastic animals, and that's the allure of it, whereas the factory farming side is the opposite. These are really plain, boring animals, so to speak, and so we can abuse them because there's nothing about them. But the circus one's different. It's almost like these animals are amazing, come see them. And so what kind of circus work did you get involved in? How was the appetite for that in terms of the everyday person, so to speak?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. Yeah, farm animals are boring to people. You know, tigers are exciting and they want to see them. So that's, why people go to the circus or have done. I mean, I've done a few projects in circuses. Again, sort of surveillance stuff, you know, from the edge of zoos and from the edge of circuses, and also sort of some of the training places that they go to, and some of the overwintering grounds, because some circuses are sort of just running through the year and then they go to a sort of overwintering area, like a big chateau, you know, with massive great walls, and they're sort of stuck there for the winter. But the work that I've done around that area is sort of primarily been trying to understand or see the relationship between owners or trainers and animals. And you know, it's kind of mystifying, you know, sometimes, because like I was saying earlier, maybe the factory farmer, the lady who farm rabbits, you know, loves her rabbits, wants to be around them, they're her company. And you know, a lot of circus people are the same view it in the same way, you know, that they are caring for these animals and they're providing a service for the public. I mean, the circus stuff with infiltration, I worked on some projects in mainland Europe, and it was primarily sort of looking at the journeys, you know, young lions and tigers were making as they started out prior to joining the circus. And I met a very odd trainer who's very well known in the sort of 70s, but he lives in just a sort of residential village in sort of central France. His property is a terraced property. It backs onto neighbours. It runs quite a long way, the garden. But, you know, he has like 17 lions back there, you know, several tigers, a few bears, a few cubs, you know, wolves. This is all in sort of village France, you know, with neighbours looking on. It's quite a bizarre setup, really. He sort of breaks them in and gets a buyer for them from you know, a bigger circus, and yeah, the bond's broken fairly quickly with the mother and the siblings. You know, they may spend a bit of time together, and then, you know, after 5 or 6 months, you know, they're sold off generally to different circuses, because circuses are really still quite active in mainland Europe. But yeah, it's just a very sad life, you know, just watching elephants sort of doing repetitive stereotypic behavior over and over again. You know, just I just always hear like the little clink of the chains, you know. You just, it's like being down in Cornwall, I like to hear the clink on the sails of the boats, you know, in the wind. You just hear that clink, 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 clink. And but you hear that around circuses as well, with elephants, you know, that have tethers around them, chains around their feet. But even not just the big majestic animals, you know, like the sea lions. You know, sea lions, the ones that I sort of followed for a while, were 30 minutes performance, you know, in front of a crowd under the canvas, and then 23 and a half hours in the back of a truck, which had like a bathtub in there. That was it. And they'd just be, I'd watch them marched out from the truck into the canvas, 30 minutes, and then march them back into the truck, lock the door behind. So yeah, it's very sad. And I mean, a lot of the, with this particular place, he actually like retires a lot of them as well. And you would think maybe that, you know, after all this, you know, performance and suffering and abuse, that, you know, there may be a nice pasture or a nice forest for them to go to. But it's back to a cage, you know. And they just live out the rest of their lives forlornly in a cage. And
the sea lion thing's interesting, actually, because one of the things that kind of led me to veganism, I guess, was I used to love going to zoos. I mean, a lot of people did, and part of the allure of zoos is seeing animals, and you're an animal lover, and that's wonderful. And I remember I'd gone to one zoo and really loved the sea lions there. And they didn't do any shows, but they were in a very small enclosure when I think back at it. And I just remember thinking they were hilarious and wonderful. And so I went to the next time I went to a zoo, this was in Barcelona, actually. So me and my partner, we went to the zoo together, and we were going to have a wonderful day. We were so happy. We were so excited. And then we went to see the sea lions because there was a sea lion show. And we sat down and we were looking, ready to think this was, you know, ready to really love it, thinking it was going to be amazing because sea lions are the best. And then we saw the trainer come out and the sea lions were there. And after about a minute, we just said, I can't, this is terrible.
Yeah.
And so we got up and walked out and we left. And then we started wandering around the zoo. And all of a sudden we looked in this bear enclosure, and it was just a bear sat there, just so forlorn. Just as you, that word you said as well, just this forlorn, just totally, I mean, like living but dead, you know. And and then all of a sudden it kind of clicked to me, and that was the last time I ever went to a zoo. And this was and it was interesting because I still, after that, we went to a restaurant and we ate chicken and stuff, and we were talking about how we you know, we thought it was horrible. And we said, we're never going to go to zoos again, we know, we're never going to go to aquariums, we'll never see any of this, but we still ate chicken. But that, I think that was a really pivotal moment for us.
And sounds like
it. Yeah, sea lions, that must have been heartbreaking for you, because they are such characters. And
it's I mean, obviously, you know, someone like Joanne MacArthur, We Animals, does amazing documentary photography around circuses and zoos. And yeah, definitely, you know, if people want to see that real visual issue up front and raw, I would have urged anyone to look at, you know, that kind of material, because, the penny probably will start to drop then, you know. If you're curious minded and inquisitive and stuff.
But that visual element is so important. I think this really goes back to what one of the first things you were saying about, you felt that there was the appetite that people needed to be visually confronted with these things. And I completely agree with that. I mean, I think most people that are vegan now, part of that element was definitely that visual confrontation of, this is what's happening to animals. You know, you can turn away and ignore it, but it doesn't change the reality of what's happening. And so I think that's why these undercover investigations are just absolutely have been. Well, I mean, I guess the question would be, continue to be, but they definitely have been so important. And maybe we'll go back to some of these stories you're talking about. But
sure.
While we're on this tangent, Do you think that progressing forward, there is still a need for these investigations in the same way that it has been for the past two decades or so?
I think there is, you know, especially in countries that are developing from a bad place and maybe, you know, are starting to have factory farming forced on them a bit more. Yeah, there's lots of taxpayers' money flowing in from Europe into, you know, Latin America and Africa, which is tied up with new factory farm developments there for the first time. That's the model. So, yeah, I definitely think there's a lot of scope internationally for that work. And also, just from a general policing perspective, you know, an enforcement perspective, it's only really the likes of us that are going to be able to bring that to light. So I think it's incredibly important, and I think it's going to be here for a while. My personal moment in saying, actually, I think for me it's enough now, was when I saw Okja, movie Okja. I don't know how aware people are of that movie, but it's worth checking out because it's a mainstream film. I mean, it was shown on Netflix, and it really did cover the whole animal issues and also like the investigative documentary stuff that went with investigations in animal rights communities across the world. So I actually saw that and I thought, maybe I don't have to do this now. It's not such a fringe issue. It's found a place, and there are plenty of other, you know, talented people that are able to do this work and want to do this work, for me to go, actually, yeah, that's enough for me.
Yeah, I think the first point about the accountability, I think, is really, really important. I actually agree with that. And I think even with the CCTV element, you know, there's a lot of campaign about getting CCTV into slaughterhouses. And I think, you know, one of the negatives for that might be this perceived idea that therefore there is that accountability, but there's still issues with, you know, who's viewing the footage, who's checking the footage. Yeah. You know, you still need whistleblowers within those slaughterhouses to get these people into trouble. So even in the inclusion of something like CCTV, I still think that accountability needs to be held. Absolutely, and so I agree with you on that point. Absolutely. And so Okja, that's interesting that you say that. Okja is a powerful film for so many people.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that I think it's almost quite nice that was like almost the bookmark to signify the end, you know, of that journey for you. Yeah, and so so it's only been relatively recently that you've kind of passed on, passed from that stage of your life, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. October last year was when I started to really sort of wrap things up and wrap that up with sort of some training on doing investigative work for Ukrainian animal activists. So I went to Kiev and started to help them think about how to do this in this country. And I mean, just the fact that we're talking about Ukraine here is for me just incredible. But there's pockets of, you know, people like that are, you know, popping up all over the world right now. You know, veganism and animal activism isn't just something that we've got used to in the UK and the States and Australia. It's percolating right through communities up and down the global highways. So, it was really nice to go and do that and just pass on a little bit of knowledge.
Yeah, I mean, it's good because as you say, Ukraine, and you think of like Eastern Europe, and it's amazing that there's that shift happening. And we think there's a lot of amazing things happening in the Middle East as well. And you think these areas of the world would be, veganism wouldn't be a thing and people don't care. But actually, even in these areas where you think that there wouldn't be that much veganism or advocacy, there actually is this really strong emerging scene. And for me, that's one of the most hopeful things. I think there's, you know, being in the UK, again, sometimes one of my things I have to pinch myself over is whether or not I'm living in some sort of bubble for veganism. Because London, I mean, my goodness, London's amazing for vegan food and everything about veganism. And so sometimes I just have to remind myself, okay, there is a world outside of London in terms of veganism. But even then, when I do that, I go, well, actually, the state of that's even better than I would have thought it would be. And so it's just hope, I guess, on so many different levels.
Yeah, we always, you know, have stereotypes about certain places and certain countries, and you know, we're further along the journey than others, but you know, sometimes that isn't the case. And you know, countries like Poland, who, you know, just 10 years ago I was doing a lot of work in factory farms, pig factory farms there, and just thought, god, how will this ever change? You know, you know, it's just so vegan friendly now, and you know, communities are rising up against factory farming developments, and you know, having success. So it's more than what we can probably imagine is really happening on the ground. So it's good stuff.
It is good stuff. It's amazing. You said something earlier, and I found it quite poignant, I guess, or I found it relatable in a sense. And it was the noise of the chains clinking together. And you said that there's that noise in Cornwall. You find it a lovely noise, but it also has the connotations of the elephants with chains. And so one of the things that sometimes I struggle with, not struggle necessarily, but I have these moments where, and it's normally with pigs for me. So I've heard pigs screaming in slaughterhouses and in trucks and things. And sometimes I'll hear like the screeching of tires, or I don't know, something like maybe a kettle, you know, when you get those kettles that go on hobs and they make those squealy noises when you do. And all of a sudden those noises become, it's almost like you just over there again, listening to it again. Do you ever find yourself having those moments where a noise or a smell perhaps or something, and it takes you back to that farm or to the circus or wherever, and you kind of have that gut feeling of, you know, this is something.
Definitely. Smells is interesting, actually. Because we're, I think, probably led, like, as activists and investigators by what we see, and our eyes are really, really important to us. But yeah, smells are really important. I'm very familiar with ammonia from broiler chicken farms. Right. You know, broiler chickens are, you know, 30,000, 40,000 in the shed for 7-8 weeks. And yeah, the litter beneath them is, you know, going to get contaminated over that period of time, so much so that, you know, they'll get burns and blisters from being on that bedding that's wet and sodden from all the, you know, urine. And so that creates an ammonia smell, and, you know, sometimes it's really, really powerful when the shed doors open, and yeah, you can see the fans at the back of the unit, and, you know, they're meant to be extracting and bringing in better air, but, you know, it just can't cope with what it's coming across right then. Also, yeah, urine is probably seems a bit weird to think about, but I spent a couple of winters in the States infiltrating fur trappers and joining their, some were in gangs, some were individuals. And, you know, scent was very important to them, you know, having really obnoxious smells. And they would lay that scent, you know, on the ground, and then obviously beneath that would be buried a trap, you know, a leg hole trap that would spring into action the moment, you know, an animal had gone to investigate that smell. So, that definitely triggers some moments. It's interesting you say that, because I'm always, thinking about what I've seen, but what I smell is actually, just as important, I think.
I think smells is one of the most powerful senses in terms of triggering memories or those moments. And so when you working within the fur trade or infiltrating within the fur trade would be more appropriate to say, of course, you were kind of you had connections with the people that were doing the trapping, so to speak. You'd obviously, and I guess the question from that is, I think a lot of activists, especially with fur, have this real notion of, you know, people that wear fur are evil, and so the people that trap animals and, you know, collect the fur, so to speak, must be horrible. And would you say, would your experience with these people validate those viewpoints, or was it more of you kind of saw that human side in them, and you just saw that they were doing something that was wrong, but it didn't make them a bad person? I mean, what are your views, I guess, with the humans in general within these industries?
With fur trapping, I sort of worked across 4 different groups of fur trappers across several different states, you know, far enough away that I wouldn't be known to the others, so that they would be talking to each other. But yeah, I sort of generated some cover stories that allowed me to find ins with these people, and then I was able to shadow and also learn to do this job. And this is, you know, one of the areas that, you know, is always so difficult for me to sort of like talk about and discuss, you know, being a part or trying not to be a part of something, but having to be close enough to it to document. And I often think about it in terms of like, if you're watching a performance, you know, I'm not on the stage all the time, but I'm in the first row, you know, and the lights are on me just enough to be seen, but not enough to be really sort of noticed or considered as to why I really might be there. But yeah, fur trappers, very different sets of people. Group of prison guards, you know, work the night shift at a maximum security prison, hunt as a pack during the day, you know, checking their trap lines across 50 miles on quad bikes, you know, forest and riverbank and field. And then there'd be another guy who would be, you know, leading his church on a Sunday, you know, a community figure, someone that people looked up to, on every level seemed a really normal guy. But when he was trapping, something turns him into, you know, someone very, very cruel. And yeah, it's all walks of life. I think about trapping is it's so odd, you know. It's, you know, we don't need to trap to wear, you know, skins on our backs anymore. We don't need to trade with them. But trapping really hasn't changed that much from like 500 years. It just gets passed on by generation to generation, trapper to trapper, father to son. But people, some are full-time professional, you know, trapping all the time. Some are just doing it at the weekends, you know. And the weekenders can be, you know, worse than the people doing it day to day. It's very odd, you know.
Yeah. I feel like one thing that we try to do, I guess, as humans, is we like to box people and say, well, this person is involved in this, so therefore they must be all evil. You know, and most people are good, but you know, the, you know, serial killers, for example, or whoever, you know, they must just be pure evil. Every thought must just be evil. And we forget that actually, well, they are kind of regular people, you know, for the most part, that do regular people things, but then they have this side of them that they engage in this really atrociously evil act. But we can't, and so it becomes really difficult to try and box people into those neat little ideas, because, well, as you say, you have this community potential vicar or priest or whoever it might be in the community who is respected, but then does this horrible thing. And it's like, well, how do you label that person? How do you view them? Because they're obviously not, there's good aspects to them, but they engage in this horrible thing as well. And that's a real difficult struggle to have within yourself. I must imagine when you were there, you know, it must have been, must have felt, did you feel angry or upset, or were you kind of, did you distance yourself from those emotions because for your own safety more than anything?
Yeah, I mean, I think this kind of work, especially the work that brings you into very close contact with individuals involved with animal cruelty, yeah, you have to try and find that distance. Obviously, you know, to avoid triggers that are going to set your emotions running, you are there to document and, you know, trying to look a bit further down the line about, you know, what the value of that could possibly be. So, but you know, there are real tests, you know, they're real emotional tests to overcome with this work, and particularly that kind of stuff. Trapping is, you know, abhorrent. It's brutal, you know, it's really brutal. And some of the incidents, I'll never really forget any of those. But I just don't, I think it's just been, like I say, it's been passed down generation to generation, and it's finally reaching a generation where people are starting to question it. And okay, my dad did it, but do I want to own a factory farm, or is it right for me to go fur trapping? My friends don't want to wear fur. They tell me at school it's not cool, you know. But my dad does that, and maybe I shouldn't be a part of that. Maybe I should say no to him. So I guess we just hit those generations that know a bit more about the facts. You know, stuff isn't hidden from them. And are more curious than perhaps what came before, you know. And you know, are more caring collectively as people, and less perhaps individually focused. I'm not sure. It's very difficult, isn't it, to unravel
it is
personal behaviour. But community leaders, you know, a lot of those people, they don't need to trap. It's just fun, you know, it's just a weird fun.
But people do these things for fun, don't they? I mean, I had been fishing a couple of times, and it's purely for fun.
Yeah.
And so I guess trapping an animal and hunting a fish is the same thing, really, isn't
it?
And so I guess it's that cultural thing that, you know, whatever would be one thing we deem acceptable, the other we don't. And yeah, it's a tricky one. It's a real tricky one. I think society is, because we're a lot more interconnected now, and we're a lot more, we're more connected. And so family values and family ethics and these things that were generally passed on, we can kind of find our morals and values from other places now, based on what we see online and what we experience in this, you know, big world that we're all, you know, part of. We're not so isolated and relying on our family just to tell us what's right and wrong. And so I think that maybe causes younger generations to have these, I guess, epiphanies perhaps, where they go, wow, okay, maybe my dad's wrong and my mom's wrong, and, you know, farming rabbits or hunting bobcats and you know, and cougars or whatever animal it may be. Of course, they can question that now in a way that maybe their dads and their granddads weren't able to.
They had the conviction to do that, you know. And I think maybe if I look at the fur trappers, you know, where they work together as groups, they're quite tight knit, they're quite tribal, they don't really want to question each other, they just do it.
Was there an era of or would you say, like, increased, like, masculinity in like fur trapping compared to, say, the rabbit farming, for instance?
It's very skewed that way. Yeah, people are really quite competitive, you know. They're competitive and, they want to show off their catches to their mates, you know. It's a bit like trophy hunting, I suppose, you know. It's, for some reason, they've done what they've done and then they have to document it. They want to take a photo to show others what they've done.
I see that on Instagram, you know. Sometimes I get tagged in these things and it's like, sometimes it could be someone as young as 14, or it could be someone 40 or 50, and they're holding up maybe five coyotes or something, and it is like a symbol of pride to them. And maybe this could be a challenging question. I met an undercover investigator before, and one of the things he grappled with was the notion that some people might think badly of him for being involved in these things.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, the question I would ask you is, do you ever feel worried that someone, you know, because you wear the undercover investigator badge quite openly and quite proudly, and you know you're not afraid to tell people that you've been involved in these things, which I think is really admirable. But do you ever worry that someone might be like, well, how could you ever do that as a vegan? You know, I'm a vegan, I could never put myself in that situation.
I mean, that's something I'm comfortable with now, but for two decades, it wasn't something I was comfortable about. I mean, I didn't share my work with anyone, really, apart from my really, really close family and friends. My parents have an inkling, but not a great deal of understanding of what that work was. And I think that's essential, you know. If you want to do that work, you have to be, you know, very low profile, and you have to enjoy your own company, and you have to be prepared to, you know, go through loneliness for quite a long period of time. I don't ever worry about what other people, you know, may think for, you know, being close to this kind of stuff and trying to find that, tread that line where, you know, you're not actively participating or involved, you're just documenting and you're keeping a distance that keeps you away from it. It was more of a concern while I was doing it, you know. Obviously there's risks that, especially if you're doing infiltration, there's risks that come from doing that work, and being seen and noticed to do it. But I'm less worried about that now. That period's gone, it's finished. The work's out there. It's not so much of a concern. There's some things I'll keep. Yeah, I wouldn't be giving you my address, for example. We've spoken about where I am, but, you know, I wouldn't be doing that. I'll keep that quite closely guarded. But yeah, I mean, I hope most people understand that this work is, yeah, it's really feeding into a bigger machine, and that machine is, you know, really trying to get people fully aware of what's being hidden from them, you know, how the food on their plates is produced, you know, why there aren't any smiles and the animals performing for them. So, yeah, I might have gone off topic or strayed a little bit from your question there, so remind me if I did.
No, I mean, I think one of the reasons I alluded to that question is, a situation I had was on a dairy farm, and we filmed the separation of a calf from their mother. And part of me felt this weird feeling like that I was somehow complicit because I didn't like get in front of the farmer and say, no, you know, you're not allowed to do that. But I mean, rationally, I know that it's not going to stop it. You know, you know, if I put up enough fuss, the police will arrive, they'll take me. So the calf is going to be taken from the mother, and there's nothing I can do about that. And so even though, like, I think rationally I knew that this was the best thing for me to do, emotionally I still felt a little bit like I was complicit in a way. And and it's not, I don't really struggle with that idea because I've tried to be as rational as I can be. Obviously that's a challenge often, but so I probably feel that's probably the same for you. Like you have those emotions, those moments where you're like, you know, I don't want to be doing this, but the bigger picture is above my emotions and above that sadness that I feel. And I guess that's maybe I was alluding to, if you ever felt that emotional burden of like, am I complicit in this?
Yeah, no, I've definitely thought about it. And I know others that I've, you know, worked with from time to time, you know, I've thought about that too. I've really been really focused on changing the systems, you know, and trying to bring big weights of evidence down on an industry, not so much on individuals or one particular company. It's all going into, you know, trying to make as bigger impact as possible against an industry to show that, you know, what they're doing is wrong, and they shouldn't be able to justify what they're doing is right. So, but yeah, it's. I mean, there's definitely been areas of investigative work where I look back on and it's not hang my head in shame, but it's just fight my conscience a little bit. I mean, for example, with trapping, the only way I could get into these groups was to trap and, you know, to try and become the worst trapper ever. That was my target. You know, I wanted to be close enough to see what they do and document as they do it. But I didn't want to make any of the traps go off. And often I'd set the traps in the day with them, and then I would go back at night and unset them or make something happen to make sure that I couldn't be complicit in my own mind of, you know, causing an animal to lose its life. So it's a bit of a challenge sometimes looking back on some of it, but I think in the main I'm fairly happy with the path that I managed to sort of strike on it.
Yeah, absolutely. And you said something which I think is important, which is targeting systems. And this is something you said earlier about, you know, going after the dozens of farms with different companies and even different countries. And I think that's really important as well about, I guess, one of the risks, and I've seen this happen before with undercover investigations, is, you know, it, often to get the media awareness, it has to be maybe a big company or something terrible has to happen. And then I guess I think sometimes really good investigations can sometimes get diminished in value because it becomes about that one farm or one practice or that one bad farmer. And so, and I think you're absolutely right, it's about, you should to build like a canon of work, a catalogue, to say you can't say it's just one farm, this is the system that's the problem. And I think that's the direction that is vital.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think showing the system's wrong and breaking the system is the way to do it, rather than breaking an individual. Because, you know, that individual, you know, some of them, I think, have regretted what they've done anyway. But
yeah, I'm sure some do. You know, it's always hard because you always know that there's some that don't. But I think that you're right. And again, something you said right at the beginning was about how they would goad with electric prods, and it was often out of frustration, you know. And we released an investigation into a dairy farm, and it showed the workers punching and beating the animals. And so and I remember some farmers had commented saying, well, you try and, you know, how would you deal with it if you were trying to get, you know, a cow to move and they wouldn't move, what would you do? And it's like, well, obviously we wouldn't put them in that situation to begin with, but in their heads there is no other situation. That is the situation, they have to do this job and the animals aren't moving. And so they try and the moral, like, you know, loops they have to jump through to try and I can't imagine sometimes like that, being in an environment where all you've ever known, especially as a young kid, is this work and this and this is the way to do it, and that's the way to do it. And I can't imagine what it would be like to have someone saying, you're wrong, this is wrong, this footage says that you're a horrible person.
Yeah.
You know, because maybe in their heads they're like, well, what else was I supposed to do? This car wasn't doing what I was doing. And objectively, it's horrific.
Yeah.
But in their heads, they're like, well, you know, I need to give people milk and this is the only way to do it. And so it's just, and that's why I think it's always about the systems. I think that's really important. But it's easy to get wrapped up in the individuals as well, isn't it?
It is because, we're emotional creatures and, we can turn on each other, unfortunately, and people do. But I think the best, and I think most of the groups that use investigations are working, you know, on a bigger level. Certainly if an individual case warrants, serious action, then of course we should do it.
Well, that's the little caveat to that is people should still be held accountable for the things that they do. And even if they don't necessarily see it as being harmful, there is an objective, a law, but also just an objective moral compass, I think, and that dictates that even though we should try and understand what leads people to doing this, it doesn't mean they're they should not be held accountable for those things. And that's a really important point. And so I would like to talk about not as nature intended, but there was one question just before, and I guess now that you're relatively out of that line of work, do you feel that now you're allow just to kind of live your life in a way that you're not having to pretend to be someone else?
Exactly.
You're just rich, and you're just you again.
Yeah, I know myself again, definitely. For a long time, I sort of not knowing myself and playing a part, playing a character in order to do this work. So it's really cool getting to know myself again a little bit more. And I think I never realized it would go on so long. And sadly, it did go a long time, and I probably did lose myself a little bit along the way. But now I've kind of definitely, remembered who I was and what I stand for. And I'm sort of trying to make up for that a little bit now.
And so you're doing a lot of work. Well, you work for Veganuary now, and so you've kind of gone from because Veganuary for me, that type of advocacy and activism is so positive and hopeful. It's a real optimistic form of activism. So you've kind of gone from this one side where it was a lot of what you did, it was probably didn't feel that optimistic, a lot of it maybe was quite pessimistic, where you doubted and you often struggled, I don't know if this is true, but maybe you struggled to see, you said in Poland you're like, how is this ever going to change, but now with Veganuary it's almost like the opposite, where that change is tangible, and the whole form of advocacy is about that change. How's working, you enjoying that kind of new
I was definitely looking to jump back into like solution-based campaigning, having focused on problems for a long time, and feeling that yes, people are aware of these systems, and there are solutions emerging every day that don't rely on those systems. So I thought it was a good time to take on that side of campaigning again. And it is really nice because it is all really positive and really inspiring and really supportive and non-judgmental. It's just, Veganuary is non-judgmental. It's so nice.
Yeah.
It's give it a try. And, so many people do give it a try, go on to make it a full, lifelong commitment, if you like. So it's definitely nice being on that side of it and not having to sort of force the tough stuff on people. But there's good people out there who do, who can help do that. So
it's about balance, isn't it? And I guess now, exactly. You can pass that mantle over to someone else, and now you can focus on, on the victory of having 250,000 signups this January and the biggest Veganuary ever so far, and building on all that wonderful work as well, which is absolutely good.
Yeah, it's nice times. And one of the also nice things that I'm doing at the moment is providing a home for farm animals and dogs and cats that I haven't been able to help at the times that maybe I would have liked to have done in the past. So myself and Prue, my lovely fiance, we've got a little micro sanctuary on the go in Cornwall at the moment. So we tend to have between sort of 15 and 20, hens, ducks, dogs, cats around at any point. So it's really nice investing some time in them, and you know, we're like hell bent on making sure they have the best possible lives after, you know, the lives that they've had so far, which were, you know, which were obviously not great. So that's nice as well.
That's lovely. It's like a big, it's just, you've gone through so many stages of helping animals in so many different ways, and now it feels like the help is more tangible, like you can see the, you know, the animals there, and it's the help isn't kind of filming and raising awareness, it's day-to-day handling and helping, and that must be rewarding.
Yeah, it just reminds me of, like, you know, when I was a kid following my mum and dad around, you know, feeding the chickens and tripping over the tortoises and
back to
that again, having something to care for that I know I can give the time to and the commitment, and yeah that's super nice.
But at the same time, you're collating your body of work and publishing it into a book.
Yeah, so Not As Nature Intended is like this, well, as kind of was looking through my journal extracts, because I've got tons of notebooks from all these investigations where I write down everything that I've seen, and then obviously I've got like a big archive of images and footage, and about 5 years ago, you know, I started looking through them, and someone just said, oh, you should make sure you hang on to that, and you know, just sort of, you know, you might come back to it at some point, you know, revisit it. And so yeah, I sort of thought, well, maybe I might do that when I finished my last investigation, just having a flick through them and stuff. And then I just thought, actually, there's a lot of stories in here that haven't been told, because like I said, focus so much on like taking down the system. But I am finding lots of individual stories that, you know, would be nice to tell, because I think they're important and they haven't been told before. Maybe they didn't quite make the investigative package that the NGO put out. But also like the experiences, now I think about it a bit more, about the people that I've met, sort of working day in, day out with your adversaries, and what that felt like. And like I say, you know, trying to understand, you know, what makes them do the things that they do. And for some of them, you know, they will try and justify it, and some of them won't be able to do. So it's just looking back on the issues, the individuals, the people, and how I've spent time with them. And it's been put into a book at the moment called Not As Nature Intended, the same thing. And I'm working with a British publisher called Unbound, who a really nice publisher. They get behind lots of sort of projects that, you know, don't always find it easy to get into the mainstream, but maybe important issues of the day, but just written from a different perspective. So yeah, they're supporting me with it, and it's crowdfunded, and I'm at 83%. I've got about another 4 weeks on it, so I'm almost there. So
how can any listeners, where can they find that crowdfunder?
It's just, if you go to www.notasnatureintended.com, and that'll take you to the Unbound page. And yeah, you can pledge for a book. And what's nice about this is everyone who supports the project, I list their name in the book as someone who helped support it. And there's a few other things, you know, like you can get involved with, you know, with some rescue hands and things like that. So it's a really odd journey for me to try something like this. And but it's been nice getting to meet people and, you know, find people all across the world that are interested in, you know, having these stories shared. And if I do that, then I can feel like I've not kept hold of anything, you know, every right. little bit of information, intelligence, image, story, I can offload into the world, and hopefully, you know, it'll be there for people to make an informed choice for themselves or learn something new. So yeah, it's for people in the animal rights community, but it's also for the curious minded, you know, anyone who's taken a carriage ride and thought, oh, what is the story of that horse? Or, you know, everyone who's you know, worn a fur coat and thought, how do they make these coats, you know? So yeah, if you're curious, it's maybe worth having a look into.
Absolutely, yeah. And yeah, so I think it must be, I guess it's that element of, there are a lot of stories that you didn't get to tell, that the NGOs didn't get to pick up, and now you can tell those stories in your own way. And yet, I guess it's kind of like offloading those memories, offloading those pictures and sharing them. And then, yeah, I think that's wonderful.
Yeah, and that'll be me done then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess that's the final chapter, so to speak.
Yeah, exactly.
That's nice. Well, thank you so much, Rich. I think we've been talking for maybe, what, 80, 85 minutes?
Oh, yeah, wow.
It's not bad, right?
It's gone past. It's gone real fast.
It's good. So we'll wrap it up there, as I don't want to keep you for too long. But I just want to say thank you for everything you've done and also continue to do. And thank you for all the awareness you've raised and for changing people, because I think I said this to you before, but the reason I changed was from seeing this kind of footage, and it made me come to terms with what I was paying for. And I know so many people, you know, like that. So thank you so much for everything you've done and for all the awareness you've raised. But thank you also for appearing on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks. Lovely to meet you and to chat to.
So perfect. All right. Well, anyone's listening, do go check out Not As Nature Intended and support the crowdfunder if you can. And thank you so much for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this podcast and you found it insightful. And I will see you next week. And in the meantime, have a good week. If you're vegan, then be active and speak up. And if you're listening, you're not vegan, firstly, thank you. And I hope that these stories and these tales have inspired you to maybe look into, you know, what is behind the meat, the dairy, the eggs, the fur, the leather, all these products, and do some investigating on your own. But until next week, take it easy and we'll speak soon.